Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's time for part two of our presentation of the September 29th panel discussing the future of graphic literature. Joshua Fialkoff and a bunch of his friends got together at one of the Los Angeles public libraries. The panel, if you haven't heard part one, consisted of Josh, Ross Ritchie, the publisher behind Boom Studios, writer and current editor-in-chief at Boom, Mark Wade, Marvel and Wildstorm writer Christos Gage, Kazu Kabuishi, the artist and editor behind the successful anthology series Flight from Image, and Tony Fleece, the writer-artist of In My Lifetime. The discussion continues, and it will touch upon more issues that I think, again, are things that we all talk about in comic book stores and amongst our comic friends, and the panel provides some very interesting insights. So I hope you enjoy this part two of this very interesting panel on the future of graphic literature. Part two starts off with an audience question where I was able to get enough of the sound, so I left the question in. However, most of the questions were not mic'd, so it's tough to hear them. So I will jump in and provide the gist of what the question was, and that will kind of make the conversation continue to be reasonably seamless.
I think this... lady had a question.
Could you talk about the relationship, the interaction between the web and comics? I mean, I think of comics as very much a medium, but I know that more and more is happening online. I just recently discovered that some of the daily newspaper comics I can go and, I missed that one, I can go back and catch up. But it just seems like a very odd, sort of uncomfortable fit. But I'm sure there's lots going on out there. I just haven't thought to look to the web for actual comic content.
Azu, go.
Well, our anthology actually, it wouldn't have come together if it wasn't for the web. A lot of the people who worked on the book are web cartoonists, and they still are. I'm still a web cartoonist. I do a monthly comic. I just started up again after production on Amulet. I don't know. I think it's just another distribution model. I guess web comics are a little fickle. A lot of comic artists that I know who are successful webcomic artists, they tend to sell shirts and other associated products to make a living. And they have to be more salesmen, more like salesmen than print comic artists who can focus on the work itself. So on the web, I think they're reaching larger audiences, but they're less willing to spend the money. However, I do think it's a good way to get the work known. And in my case, a lot of the readers of my comics were artists. So I knew that even though I had a small fan base, it was a really tightly knit fan base of other creators that I respected. And I asked them if they'd like to put a book together with me. And that's how our project really came together. And we continue to work online. We work in an online forum and put the book together there. I'm probably not the best person to talk about web comics. I sit in a strange, I'm like straddling the fence between print and web. I think I'm one of the few web comic cartoonists that makes a decent amount on my web comic because I sell prints of them. And I actually, my friend who runs a gallery and a store, he makes prints of my comics, and they sell about $1,500 worth of prints a month. And I don't even work on that comic. It just kind of sits there. And so I found a strange and very niche business model for that particular thing. But I wasn't looking for it. I was just putting stuff out there. It's a good way to get started. I think a lot of people just get started on the web and then they move to print. And in my case, it was kind of that's how it worked.
You see, you were talking about for the artist being able to do a graphic novel in chunks. Do you think that's another way to break it down?
Yeah, actually, I really wanted to do a graphic novel on the web first. I think after I'm financially comfortable doing my print stuff, I'd really like to put my foot forward and do that and just give it a shot. Like I would do a weekly comic, serialized adventure comic that every week you'd get like 10 pages or something like that.
I think that's the biggest hurdle right now is that we're trying. That's a whole new business model that is in the very very formative magma stages of trying to be built, and we don't. We don't have a business formula for it yet. There's no you can be a web cartoonist all day, but there's no there's micropayments, there's a bunch of other little ways to get money, but nobody has found, unless I'm in last week and I wasn't paying attention.
Well, the business model seems to be attached to the idea of building an online community.
Right.
So the most successful example of webcomics is Penny Arcade.
Right.
And they're successful because they basically represent the video gaming community, which is massive. It's so much bigger than the comics community. So even if they got a small portion of that, they'd still have a wider audience than comics does. So basically, they just draw comics for that community. Comics, and you know, when you think back in the history of comics, comics have sort of been kind of the addendum to any publication. Like, okay, here's a magazine about, you know, a Boy's Life. You know, Boy's Life magazine, the end will have a comic or something like that. And that's sort of what Penny Arcade does for the video gaming community. And they just comment on the industry.
Yeah.
And so they actually put together a convention now that's basically taken over E3. It's like the biggest video game convention in the world now. And you know, that's a business model right there. So
and talk a little
it's
bit about
really the, unconventional.
Talk a little bit about the one you mentioned a minute ago, the Kaz, what was it called? No, when she first asked a question about like the about online.
Oh, it was Kazu. I was suggesting he has much more knowledge. I mean, it's funny that you ask about this because at Boom, you know, again, I'm the business guy who's kind of the weird duck at this panel, but I'm mesmerized by what sort of opportunities there are with doing webcomics. And because the model is not clear and the way to monetize, you know, you ask five different people how to monetize webcomics, and you get five different answers. It's T-shirts, it's print collections, it's prints. There's also
ad revenue. Subscriptions. There's a lot of them. You subscribe to them to get the back catalog. Right.
Yeah, is it better to have 5,000 readers and try to do Google ads on your page, or is it better to have 200 people that pay $15 for the subscription? And you know the concept of creating community and those different things, and so it's a real challenge. And I know I'm fascinated by the opportunity and the ability to expand the audience and to get people. You know, growing up reading comic strips in the newspaper, and that notion that this is material that it could be very cartoony or it can be action adventure and very illustrator oriented, but it's a great way to reach out there and to sort of find a new audience.
And what's happening now, because I think up until very recently, webcomics were seen as sort of separate from traditional comics. But now you're having, I know DC has a huge initiative where they're trying to commission guys, it's called Zuda, where they're trying to commission guys to do webcomics for them. And I've had a couple other, publishers come to me to see about doing stuff, and it seems like the publishers are kind of going, wait a second, there's this money out there, and we have to find a way to get it. And apparently we're out. So
it's new, and it's interesting, and I think everyone is sort of circling this. I think the creators and the publishers and the audiences are circling it, trying to figure it out.
Well, if you're looking specifically for guys, I think Scott McCloud's website is probably the best way to find the best of the best. And I think it's just
Scott
McCloud.
Yeah, it's a good place to begin. Mm-hmm.
Just scottmcloud.com.
And
Scott's this guy who he's written a couple books about comics, how to make comics, how to read comics, how to sell comics that are in comic form and totally genius. Like they're really like, if you want to write comics, you should just read this book because it really tells you a lot of what you need to know. And he's made a point of really pioneering what you can do with graphic storytelling on the web. Everything from kind of flash animated comics to interactive comics to kind of, you know, choose your own adventure style comics to more traditional, you know, more traditional three panel gag strips to, you know, ongoing adventure comics. I mean, everything. And so there's a huge world of it out there. And I think there's a lot of guys who are coming out of that and coming into print comics and a lot of guys who are bypassing print comics. And like, as Kazu said, like, there's a lot of people who make a really, really good living just doing that stuff. And there's a lot of, and I think because of the medium, because of the fact that it doesn't cost, like the cost is so much less, you're really just paying for bandwidth. You get a lot more experimental stuff and you get guys doing really exciting things, that just the nature of the comic market as it is kind of precludes them from trying out.
The,
The fans of the webcomic, too, I've witnessed, just being at conventions, like seated next to somebody that runs a webcomic, they are way more rabid than regular comic book fans, because they sort of, they feel like they're in on a joke, like they found something.
Yeah, they found the new band. Nobody's found yet. Yeah, yeah.
And so they're loyal, and they're fiercely involved in what's going on with the comics.
That's probably, you know, where we get our, you know, hardcore fan base. Right. It's all the online stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even, I don't know if we want to, before we leave the web stuff, beyond web comics, the web has really changed how the comics industry works, period. And Mark, I don't know if you want to talk about the old days, how things worked.
We had to carve our comics in stone tablets.
Really?
Yeah. No. It's funny. I was asked this question the other day, because we're doing Boom is doing a comic for one of the video game publishers, and the question was, he says, "Well, what, like the original artwork? Actually, what happens to the original?" Because they were interested in buying some of the original artwork on the book, and I said, "Well, the reality is there's very little actual tactile material produced anymore. I mean, about half our artists work completely electronically, working on the tablet and working completely on the computer. And those who don't still don't send us their original artwork. They'll draw the page or whatever, and they'll scan it in, and they'll send it off to the colorist, and they'll send it off to the production department to put lettering down, and it's all done electronically. So that's changed the method of how we do things enormously. It hasn't really changed. It hasn't really made for better comics any more than word processors made for better literature after typewriters were invented. That the invention of the word processor didn't make novels any better.
But I will have to say, all those digital concerns made it possible for me to even start Boom as a company. And has had a huge impact on the ability to be a startup, because just the FedEx expenses for the first comic book that I published would have sunk me.
Yeah.
And much less than on the print end, the innovation, the idea that you don't have to generate film that's been separated into three different colors that you composite all the colors from, that you can just take digital files, put it on an FTP site, and it gets turned into a printed object. It's, you know, had a huge impact on the business.
Yeah. I mean, the literally 20 years ago, even as recently as 20 years ago, the most time-consuming and conceivably the most expensive part of the comic book production process was getting the damn thing colored and having production be able to make it print ready. And what that would involve is, Jesus God, this isn't like talking about buggy whips. You'd have a piece of black and white artwork, and then a colorist would come along, and he would lay down colors and sort of make indications about for the production department, and then these original colored pieces of artwork would go to these this room of little old ladies in Sparta, Illinois, like the one place in America that printed comics was in this little town in Illinois, and they printed all the comics, and this room full of little old ladies would sit there with an X-Acto knife and this ruby lith, which is basically a clear sort of contact stick'em stuff, and would cut out shapes for all of the yellow things, and then cut out all of the green things had to be cut a certain shape, and everything that had a distinctive color had to be cut into the ruby lith and stuff, and you'd make different layers and stuff. I mean, it's making any sense. It's just, I mean, I feel like I'm explaining how we used to make wagon wheels, but but the phenomenal amount of time and energy put into this, that stupid process by these little old ladies, and the expense and the time, and now the notion that now it's just a matter of, as I get a black and white piece of artwork with Photoshop, I pull it up, I add some color to it, and we send it off to the printer, and that's what he prints, and that just makes things so much less expensive, so much less troublesome, and so much less error prone, because you don't have some little old lady in Waukegan missing, you know, who works in Sparta, screwing up the flesh tones and the yellow tones or whatever. That's a funnier story in my head than it came out of my mouth, but you know what I'm saying. So, that's look at it. Look, a little history of comics lesson for you right there. You didn't even look. So you learn something new every day, even when you don't try. Yay! Well, please for love of God, somebody else talk.
Another question from the audience, this one asking, why has the cost of comics increased so dramatically? Have the production costs kept the product out of people's hands because they're more expensive now than compared to the first few decades where the price range was only from a dime to a quarter?
Part of it is that we tried to catch up too fast. Part of it was we decided, wait a minute, our comics are really cheap and therefore nobody will carry them because they're so cheap. But if we make them a lot more expensive, then they become a realistic profit model for retailers. That's part of it. The other part of it is that they're just, I mean, you can speak more to this than I can, but the cost of paper has skyrocketed over the past 20 years. That alone, this cost of paper alone has been a huge factor there.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, it's relative to a lot of different things, and it's sort of a more broad discussion about inflation. You know, you look at, I could argue back that, you know, the price of a gallon of gas.
Yeah, but I'll argue with it because that's not sure. A fair comparison because we actually did a study, like Diamond Distributors, the distributor of major comics, did a study about 5 years ago, and they found that in all forms of, gasoline is the only thing that comes anywhere near the inflation rate of comic books. Not movies, not any other entertainment media, not anything, not milk, not bread, nothing compares to comics. The inflation rate on comics in the past 30 years has been like three times what it was for anything else.
I actually remember when it went from 60 cents to 65, I swore I'd never buy another comic book.
Masters.
How'd that
true
go?
Story. True story. Yeah.
Is that working out for you? Yeah.
I think that Chris's answer, the fact that there is, you know, you've got to look at there are fewer readers, but even then, I think to maybe a more specific way is I can answer on the boom end is that we have a very small readership in comparison to Marvel or DC. For Marvel and DC, their problem is what they're doing is working.
Yeah.
You know, so if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And, you know, World War Hulk is selling spectacularly well. And
but I mean, even saying that, World War Hulk is selling, you know, 100. My book, World War Hulk X-Men, sold number one, sold like 87,000 copies, which these days for a comic is a lot.
It's a phenomenal success.
But yeah. In 1985, a comic book selling 87,000 copies would get canceled. Am I wrong? Yeah.
And there's also this is way more information than you wanted to know, but there's also the concept of perceived value that we've like as a medium in the last 5-10 years or so, we tried a few times doing comics specifically on cheaper newsprint with, you know, for 99-cent retail or something that you can give to kids or that anybody can afford. And without fail, fans and retailers both look at these comics as, oh, well, these are not real comics. These must be inferior product, or they must be just for children, or you must be using, like, you know, crap talent on them or whatever, because otherwise why would they be so cheap? So the problem is we've now created a situation by which we literally don't know how to step back and make comics less expensive or in a cheaper format, because they're perceived now by those people who do read them and do buy them as that's a giant step back. There's something wrong with them.
I think another answer to your question is when you look at in the manga world, what they're doing is working. And I think the units that they're selling shows that whatever that price point is, the $9.99 with the black and white with 150 to 200 pages of content, that people are really reacting to that. And I know on the boom end, like, you know, my VP of publishing, Tom Fossbender, came to me the other day and was like, what are we doing with our graphic novels? Our graphic novels are $14.99. That's just way too cheap for what we're doing. And I know that what I was trying to do strategically was to be able to have – you can look at manga and you can look at Tokyo Pop at $9.99, and then you can look at the boom graphic novel at $14.99 and go, okay, well, it's color. Maybe that's the $5 discrepancy. But I think that it's an ongoing discussion that we're having. We're all trying to kind of figure out how to take this mass medium that has gone niche and turn it back into a mass medium, and it's sort of an ongoing dialectic until we find that – you know, the way that Tokyo Pop definitively found that format for manga that sort of the rest of the market followed, until that happens for us in graphic novels for North America, we're still trying to figure it out. Even if you look at Marvel and DC and Dark Horse, even if you just look at DC's catalog, in a single month, they'll charge different prices for different number of pages. Yeah. It's not uniform.
Scholastic won't price the paperback version of Amulet, It's a 200-page full-color graphic novel on nice paper, nice cover stock. And they won't charge more than $10 for that. They said that that's the market won't go there. And so they're going to have to print a lot of copies to make it.
And I think a lot of that, a lot of the rub of that is because of how the system hasn't evolved. Because the what we call the direct market, the specialty market, hasn't figured out this is your value. And you can't charge this if you then want to charge this. And once you see, and I know Marvel's done with, Marvel did their digest books, which were manga-sized, they were full color, and they were still $9.99. As far as I know, those books did great. It's those Runaways and some of those early books. So, I mean, there is that market. It's just a way of making your costs actually make sense for what you're doing.
But there wouldn't, but this gets back to something we said very, very early on in this panel, which is that, but those books wouldn't be possible under our system if they weren't are previously produced
underwritten
right. as monthly comic books that were already serialized, and they've already made their money back for the publishers, so therefore they can afford to go into that format. So,
a follow-up question asked about Fell and Casanova. Fell, made by Warren Ellis and Ben Templesmith. Casanova, currently by Matt Fraction and Fabio Moon. The Image books that seem to be successful, priced at $1.99, compared to the average $3 to $3.50 book.
Well, I looked at that very closely, and it really is, not to sound like a complete hack, but it's difficult to look at that as a model, because not only are you taking Warren Ellis, who commands a certain fan base, but you're adding to him Ben Templesmith, who has his own fan base. And I would say it's more representative to look at the material that's launched in the wake of Fell, like Casanova. Matt Fraction, I think, is a brilliant writer. Gabriel Moon and I'm going to screw their names up. Somebody help me.
There's a Fabio
Ba.
Moon and Ba,
right?
Because one brother started off, and then the second guy took it over. And spectacularly talented guys. One of them worked with us on Zombie Tales. Really, really gifted creators. But Casanova is, I think, at a quarter of the audience of Fell. Now, we can ascribe that to maybe the topic, or maybe it wasn't marketed well. I mean, who knows? But there's very few examples within the context. It's just that it's difficult, I know, as a publisher to look at that as a way to emulate that when you've got two huge talents in the comic book medium that are putting it together with Fell. And, you know, can you follow up in that and, create something that's much more accessible? The other aspect of it is a lot of retailers have complained. And what they've complained about is, it's $1.99. So for that space that they have on the rack,
right.
they're actually making half the amount of money that they would make if they sold, for instance, a Boom Studios comic. And so they will order less of that book and support that book less because it's not making them as much money.
I understand the paradox. The paradox is that, but if it's good, if it were selling, that would you could sell three times as many as you could of a Boom book, and therefore you're still coming back with better numbers. But they're not the comic book retailers are not known for their long-sightedness. So, yeah.
We love them.
We love comic retailers, but yes, they're not known for their depth of vision.
There's also that idea of, this new thing is going to fail has been really beaten into retailers' heads because they try out new books and the books
Absolutely.
Don't come out or the books get canceled.
And
that's where I think the kind of the beauty of the graphic novel is I wrote a miniseries that half of came out and I went through two publishers and the rest of the book was just never going to come out and wouldn't have come out. Even Ross would not publish my book. I'm just kidding.
How dare you.
I hate you, Ross. I hate you. I've been waiting all this time to put you on the spot.
The poison gas comes out of his microphone.
No, I mean, because again, it's a miniseries that half of it's come out and couldn't make a go of it. There you go.
Yeah.
But we found a second life because there was a book publisher who believed in it and who actually has the resources to make the book work and actually put it out and have it, be in Barnes & Nobles and Borders all across the country. And so that's that kind of secondary market. I know my book sold virtually nothing in the direct market. I mean, it really, I think they said it was less than 20th of the total sales were in the direct market, and that's not very many copies, let me tell you. And so this book has kind of flourished, so to speak, because of the bookstores. And I think we're going to start seeing that progressively more and more and more.
Well, I know that – I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Oh, no.
The original graphic novel that my wife and I are doing, it's interesting because we've been looking at, it's a historical epic, but it has an appeal to the Christian market, even though it's not a quote-unquote Christian-themed book like one of the Left Behind books, let's say. But we've been looking into that, and someone said to me, oh, yeah, so-and-so, you know, put out a book, a comic book based on the Left Behind books, sold almost exclusively through Christian bookstores, and it sold 150,000 copies. And I'm like, wow, A, I never heard of it,
yeah. And
I work in comics, and yeah. B, 150,000 comics would put it at the top of the sales chart if it was selling through the comic book stores, the direct market. So I think there are untapped revenue streams out there. I don't know what the terminology is. I just write the comic books. Yeah. But, you know, I think there are audiences out there that we, you know, as Roz is pointing out, that, we, you know, we just need to figure out ways to get things to. But then you have the paradox of people don't want new things. It's not just comics. Look at movies. How many sequels are out there? You know, in direct-to-video now, I have a friend who produces direct-to-video films, and he said all they want to do is sequels, you know, American Pie 5 with, you know, one guy who was in the background of the first American Pie movie as the star, you know. I mean, people don't want to take chances on new things in any area, but you have to have, you know, growth.
We answered Gary's question for so long that he left.
A gentleman asked a question about the success of books like the McSweeney collection of independent comics, Chris Ware and Harvey Pekar's collections in hardback of what is called the best American comics. The gentleman considered buying them until a friend told him a lot of the same material had been published by companies like Top Shelf and Fantagraphics for the direct market. So the question was, are the McSweeneys and the best American comics hardbacks being discovered by a different market of readers?
I think what it talks to is that comics as a niche market has a bunch of little niche markets in it.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of crossover. So you have your fans who read Batman and Superman. Even within that, you have your fans who read Batman and Superman, and your fans who read, you know, Captain America and Spider-Man. But aside from that, so you have your fans who read your superhero books, and then you have your fans who read the comics with an X or the art comics. And the twain never shall meet. And so you see a lot of these books that, like, even again with my book, it's the same thing where they do great in the bookstore market, but have, like, literally you just don't see them in comic shops. There's maybe 10 comic shops in the country who are actually carrying them. And it's an interesting, I think, also as I consider myself a genre writer, and because I'm a genre writer, I don't fit into the independent art comics. And so it becomes that sort of thing where now, so I'm doing something that's not superheroes, but I'm also doing something that's not, you know, art comics. So I'm doing something different. And it's a matter of finding that niche, because the niches are so small and everyone knows exactly what they want.
If the crunchy publishers do not touch anthologies, they basically are the worst selling books available. But I think it's because they've been put together with a mindset that these are little pieces of somebody else's side project. You know, I really, when I look at a lot of anthologies, they just look like kind of ego stroking, you know, like, hey, he's on that book, so I want to be on the book with him, you know, and then just, here's a little tiny little thing I did on the side. But with Flight, you know, this, for these people, that this is the first opportunity they've had to show their work to the world, so they put their 100%. So I've got like all these little stories that are, you know, just, I generally don't like the bigger named artists coming in because they won't do anything with as much heart as somebody who's new to it. So Flight, you know, because it's, you know, built on the spirit of an artist trying to express themselves and showing their work to somebody, and also being inspired by all the people around them, that feeling goes into the book. And then it's probably the most successful comics anthology, I think, since Mad Magazine. We've sold over 120,000 volumes of it. And for a graphic novel, that's like phenomenal, right? Except in a direct market, we don't sell very many. Yeah, we've only. But we don't, those hardcovers, I don't know. I haven't seen the numbers for them, but I imagine that they're a tough sell.
They don't do more. If a book isn't, like, that's the book publishers, really, they're in it for the money. They're not doing it for the love. I think in the direct market, the guys who make their money in the direct market, we're doing it for the love. Book publishers are, they're big, huge businesses that have what's it called, a rubric that says this is how much, if the book If we pay this much money, the book has to sell this much money, has to sell this many copies. If it doesn't sell this many copies, we will not publish the next one. And it's very cut and dry. It's got nothing to do with quality. It's got nothing to do with, you know, how the critical reception for a book. It's literally just numbers.
But I do think it's a good rule of thumb in publishing that anthologies don't sell. And the first thing that Boom ever published, my partner called me up and he said, "I've got a book for you to publish." And I said, "Oh, really? What's that?" And he said, "Zombie Tales." And I was like, "Really? You think so?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, it's going to do great." And I said, "Okay, let's do it." And I'll never forget my Diamond rep calling me up and going, "Man, you guys really sold some copy. You sold an anthology." I was like, "Really?" And he's like, "Yeah, anthologies don't sell." So I think Kazu's success with an anthology shows that it can be done. Zombie Tales certainly launched Boom. If they're doing a sequel with an anthology, that shows that there's definitely life in it. But as soon as I crossed over into more mainstream book publishing, when we signed our mainstream book publishing deal, I found out that, you know, short story collections, which, you know, these other forms of anthologies in traditional publishing are really frowned upon. So I think there'll always be people trying to do it, and there'll always be breakout projects, and there'll also be a lot of corpses along the side of the road.
A woman asked a question about how Japanese manga was able to provide a magazine format and an anthology format that was on cheap paper and, you know, was able to continue various stories that kind of fit in the same basic anthology theme, and wondered why American comics can't produce a comparable medium to sustain anthologies that way.
That's what we've been with Flight. That was the original vision. I wanted it to be a magazine. I wanted it to be disposable. That you could buy it for $5 to $10, you know, and you can get like 300 pages of comics. But the problem here is that, in Japan or in New York or in London, you have a lot of mass transit, and people. Anthologies are perfect for subway reading. You know, when you're commuting, you're like you're a mass, you know, transit. Type of person, that's like the perfect size, length for a story. It's like 10 pages of comics. You know, you can read that from station to station. And here, because everything's so dominated by cars, I think that niche is being taken up by the audiobooks. So if I wanted to go into that, into that kind of business, then I'd have to be creating some kind of anthology of audiobooks. But you know, that's why what I ended up doing was I looked for a viable means to be able to do this, to begin this. And the trade paperback format seemed to be the only option, because that way, once we create a book, Flight One still continues to sell. We can continue to sell. It's a perennial volume, so they keep reprinting it. And until the success of the book catches up with us, we won't be able to do the magazine. But I'm still focused on getting that done. It's just going to take some time, because we'll have to basically change everybody's mindset, like how they think about making comics and reading comics.
Do you want to talk about how comics are in Japan? Like, give them kind
I don't
of
know
sense
much
of...
about it. I mean, she knows just pretty much just.
Then I'll
it.
Talk about
how
it.
Do okay. You?
And for everybody who doesn't know,
yeah.
Comics, I mean, it's like.
Yeah, they sell like 6 million copies.
Yeah, I mean, it's something like 60% of the books purchased in Japan are manga. That's Japanese comics. There's comics for businessmen. There's comics for little kids. There's comic for fetishists. There's comics for soccer players. There's like literally everything that there could possibly be about you that you would be interested in. There is a phone book size comic that comes out once a week or once a month.
Once a week.
I think like the richest woman in Japan is a manga creator. Who's one of the third richest person, period, in Japan. Culturally, they fell in love with comics, and it never stopped. So kind of where we started to gravitate away from it in the 50s and 60s, they just got more and more and more and more into it, where it's totally ingrained in their culture.
And it could be pretty much traced back to one man. There's Osamu Tezuka, who's the creator of basically the Disney of Japan, and because he put the kind of energy that he did into Japanese comics, it's pretty much lasted throughout the years and became the staple entertainment over there. So we just need a Tezuka.
Come on, Mark, get to work.
Yeah, get on that. Note to self. Great.
But when you think about it, I mean, to say that a medium is for kids, you know, comics are for kids. That's like saying television is for 18 to 34 year olds, you know.
I agree.
And in Japan, as you said, you know, It's just another medium. If you're into sports, you can find manga about sports. If you're into romance, you can find manga about romance. And, you know, if you're into superheroes, yeah, you know, you can find manga about superheroes. But it's just another medium, and that's, you know, I see a lot of hopeful signs in American comics, but boy, have we got a long way to go.
A question came up asking how has the promotion of Free Comic Book Day every year been in terms of trying to generate new readers?
I probably, Josh probably has more experience in it because Josh is actually in comic books before me. But the my off-the-cuff response would be Free Comic Book Day is an initiative from Diamond. And they are the direct market comic book specialty distributor. So I would say the greatest penetration, you know, they're the ones that are taking the orders for the free comic books. And I can't speak to their book division and that interface with more mass market outlets, but I'd imagine that's why it's mostly clustered there.
In theory, I mean, for those of you who don't know, that Free Comic Book Day is something that was sort of created and spearheaded by a retailer named Joe Field 4 or 5 years ago. Just as, you know, Baskin-Robbins has the one day a year where you can go in and get like a free scoop of ice cream. Do you know this, by the way? So, but it's true. And different retail outlets have that sort of outreach program. The idea was, well, it's created a day on the calendar every year for comics where, like a Saturday, where we'll be giving away a bunch of free comics. And anybody who walks in the comic shop can walk out with a free comic book, and maybe that'll draw them back in. And there's, I mean, it's not been a failure. I wouldn't say, but it's not. It hasn't been exactly the raging success that they had hoped it would be,
yeah,
either.
But I think that's reflective of why things aren't really working in comics over here. Is that comic right there? The comics are being made for the industry,
right?
Not for the people,
right,
at large. And I think that's just another example of that. I mean, we had a free comic book day come out, you know, for Flight, and I remember telling the Image guys, like, what are you guys spending this money for? That we should be, you know, why don't we just make a whole bunch of free Flight books and just put them in bookstores, you know? Why,
yeah,
don't we do that? That would be so much more effective. But, you know, they went and did it anyway. It was good.
But it
didn't really help our –
It's also – as Ross said, it's basically, you know, it's basically underwritten through,
yeah, exactly,
through Diamond Distributors.
Yeah,
Diamond Distributors
the
makes their money distributing comic shops. They don't give a rat's ass whether or not, you know, people go into Barnes & Noble more to buy comics.
But that's part of the evolution that's happening, because we've all been trained for as publishers or as creators to essentially preach to the choir. We have a captive audience who goes into their shops every Wednesday, and every Wednesday they drop $100 on whatever books they're buying, and they keep buying what they've been buying for 25 years, and that's just kind of what they do.
And you say that, I just want to hang myself. It's true.
And the thing is that now we have this great opportunity.
But if you hung yourself, you wouldn't be able to go to the comic shop next Wednesday and spend your $100 on the things you've been buying for 25 years.
And, you know, but now we do have this great opportunity, and we have the chance to finally reach a wider and more diverse audience. And so what you see and are starting to see more of is this kind of activism. This panel is an example of that, of trying to reach out to people who don't necessarily read comics or don't even know that comics are still made. I mean, the number of people who when I talk to them are just kind of like, really? They make those? Those come out still? I mean, getting the word out and letting people know that they exist, that they aren't just for kids, that they're for everybody, and that there's really cool stuff. And in fact, you know, just about every medium right now is stealing very heavily from what we're doing. You look at a show like Heroes, which is ripped off whole cloth from comics, you know, that have been coming out for, you know, 20, 30 years now.
Well, and I think that the thing is, it takes a certain type of personality, like myself, to go to a comic shop every Wednesday and buy the comics. There are some people who just – I have a very good friend who did not read any of my work until he could get it on Amazon, because he's very busy and he only reads what he can order on Amazon and have delivered to his door. He's not going to go out and look for something. Comic shops are a niche market thing. I love them. They're great. But as you said, it's sort of preaching to the choir, and, you know, fortunately – we are finding new ways to get it out there. But, you know, I mean, I know general audiences would probably be more interested in a zombie anthology than some of the more superhero-centric stuff than Civil War, let's say.
Say, as part of the choir, I would just like to say how great Free Comic Book Day is, because you get, like, 30 free comic books for, like, totally free, no catch. You don't have to spend a nickel. You just go in. They're not necessarily putting their best foot forward all the time, but you can totally get free comic book day. So all of you that might be in the choir, don't skip that Saturday.
Yeah.
It's like Christmas.
Yeah, four hostages.
A question came up regarding the influx of Hollywood writers and novelists into comics, and have the publishers gone after other noteworthy franchises and franchise writers?
Well, we just licensed The Godfather, so that's what we're trying to do.
On paper, it sounds like a great idea, but they're still doing such a crappy job of it. Like the problem is, like let's take poor Jodi Picoult as an example. Fine writer. Really good at what she does. She was handed a bunch of Wonder Woman. She was basically – she took over Wonder Woman with issue like six of – in the middle of another six or seven ongoing plot arcs or something. And she did – she couldn't even really do a cohesive story. It was all part of like six or seven other crossover events that were happening throughout the DC universe. And so she did her five issues and left. And they're going to package that as a trade paperback. And they're going to, and a hardcover, and they're going to get it out in the stores, and it'll have her name big on it and stuff. And every single person who picks it up on the strength of her name will pick it up and read through it and be completely lost and want to blow their brains out and will never, ever, 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 ever pick up another comic book again as long as they live. Brad Meltzer is another good example. Brad Meltzer is a New York Times best-selling author. He's written a couple of comics that have been collected, and most recently some of his stuff was collected as Justice League of America. It's a hardcover that came out, I think, either last week or this week. I've been reading comics since I was six. I can't goddamn make sense of this story. and it's impenetrable unless it's continuity porn. You know, it's only for the people who've been reading comics since 1952. And if they really honestly think for one second that Brad Meltzer novel fans are going to pick this Justice League book up and go, comics, I've seen the light. I'm now going to look at more No, we're actually going to drive them away forever. So in theory, it's a great idea. The Stephen King stuff, part of the problem too is the perfect synergy is going to come when we finally like find the right outside, you know, outside of comics name to come and do something in comics that is accessible
A follow-up point was made in terms of what about things like Joss Whedon writing Buffy the Vampire Slayer for Dark Horse?
But that's a step in the right direction. But here's the problem is that the people who watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the people who go in the comic shops, the Venn diagram is the circles are much closer than they ought to be. In a perfect world, what you need to do is you need to find that, you know, best-selling horror novelist, that best-selling mystery novelist. Stephen King, same thing. Stephen King readers. I would bet most Stephen King readers know that comics exist, at least that's just a step in that direction. I know I'm rambling on, but my point is that those are all steps in the right direction. That's anything that helps bring attention back to us. The problem is we as a medium, and certainly I would lay the blame at the feet of the big two, Marvel and DC, we do a really, really, really awful job of capitalizing on that momentum. When we catch lightning in a bottle, oh, look, we got Joss Whedon doing this. Now we can get a bunch of people coming. And then we end up publishing nonsensical crap that's badly crafted, but we're counting on it selling on the basis of their name alone, and then nobody's going to come back for it.
I think there's you raise very valid points, and I agree with most of them, but there's a little bit of a catch-22 in that people like Joss Whedon, the weird reason they want to write comics is because they grew up reading comics.
Yeah.
And they come to it not because they need the money, obviously, but they want to play with the toys.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you say to a best-selling horror writer, hey, why don't you come to comics and do exactly what you do in novels but do it in comics, they're probably not going to want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, but if they grew up loving the Hulk, maybe they'll write a few issues of the Hulk, but because of the way the market is, et cetera, you know, and maybe they want to refer to comics that they read when they were kids. I don't know. So it's a tough thing to do, but I agree with you. I mean, it's interesting that this stuff, as we were talking about before, things like 300, V for Vendetta, and Watchmen, which were movies, got people interested, and they could go out and buy a self-contained story.
Yeah.
A self-contained graphic novel, that's what sold the best because it had that accessibility to it. And I think that may be where the answer lies. But, you know, like you said, anything that takes us in that direction is a good thing. But we've got challenges
there. And I think you're right. And it's like with those three graphic novels, I think what we have to do with the medium is create more great self-contained stories like, you know, 300, where the common problem is sort of, you know, somebody gets excited about 300 and they go and they buy it and they read it and they think it's really cool. And then they say, you know, what else is there?
301.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And theoretically, if you like 300, we can kick you V for Vendetta, and that's of that cloth. But I think ultimately, until comics gets to the place where there's 20 or 25 other great graphic novels that you can kind of sink your teeth into the business and really get excited about it, it won't really be solved.
A reader said that because of the films like Spider-Man and Superman, he got reinterested in comic books and was told to check out things like Ultimate Spider-Man and All-Star Superman. But then he found his own frustration when he couldn't find the monthly version of All-Star Superman and wondered if that was a missed opportunity.
I mean, yeah, but even Superman comes out like every, you know, people ask me if I, you know, did I read the last issue? I'm like, yeah, when I was a kid, you know, and I loved it. It was, so there's no, you know, it's a step in the right direction. But again, we're letting the potential audience down because we're not there for them on a regular basis.
A woman asked if enough female comic professionals are getting the opportunity to work for the big companies and with the gentlemen of the panel, because maybe there would be more female readers out there if they knew that there were more female creators making the comics.
I think that's changing.
I just know a lot of guys. I'm sorry.
But I think one of the places it's changing is...
Well, in Flight. I mean, Flight, yeah. We got the Friends of Lulu Award because we had so many women creators on the book. I mean, it's not that many. I mean, about 25% of the creators on Flight are women for the most part. And I guess that's a good first step. I mean, I think most of the comics readers out there are actually women. So
there are more women in comics than there, I would say, probably there have ever been from on the creative side, but there still aren't anywhere near enough.
Right. But there's just tons of women comics readers, and that's, yeah. You know. But just we've been talking a lot about a lot of mature comics, you know, the 300s and the Sin Cities and whatnot, and talking about them as success stories. But a lot of times Bone gets glossed over. And I think that is the most successful independent comic book in American history. I mean, just the new Scholastic trades have sold over 2 million copies in the last 2 years. And so we are neglecting the kids, actually. So when we talk about, like, kids, comics aren't for kids anymore, that's actually old news. They aren't for kids anymore. They're for just, like, you're talking about that really, really niche, you know, audience of 20-something, actually 30-something to 50-year-old people, and they're well served right now.
Yeah.
It's time to start actually doing comics for kids.
I know we're seeing a lot of the book publishers. I know Scholastic, as you said, and I think Random House Kids is also like starting to get towards. So there's a lot of the book publishers are starting young adult initiatives now, realizing that the manga is what works, and the manga aimed towards kids is what works.
I think kids like the format too. They're very dependent on their parents. Like a lot of people my age and older got their first comic when their parents bought them one at the newsstand or the grocery store to shut them up and let them do what they were doing.
Right. Or you'd be with them and literally you'd be someplace where they were and you just point and go, yeah. I want a comic book. That doesn't happen now.
It does at the Barnes and Noble and Borders now. They pick up manga. That's manga has replaced that comic, the comic book on the spinner racks.
Yeah. But the percentage of people who take their children into Barnes and Nobles is much smaller than people who bring them to Safeway.
Exactly.
You know,
which is why it was really sad to see Disney Adventures go down.
Yeah.
Because I thought that was one of the few places where it was actually kind of happening, you know, where kids could pick up a comic book.
Yeah, because it was sold in Rackage there at every supermarket right there next to, you know, the Star. And
now Nickelodeon Magazine is pretty much the last remaining comics publication on the supermarket shelf, which is really sad because it's only a small portion of the magazine.
Anybody else?
A gentleman offered a solution to the economic problem in asking if the iTunes craze that has taken over music could be applied to comics in a digital standpoint in terms of buying a download of a comic as opposed to buying a physical book.
Kind of touched upon that, the notion that the biggest problem there's no economic model for it yet. That's still in the very formative stages of how do we make money on that. We don't know.
Stuff on the web is free.
Yeah, people want everything free on the internet.
Yeah. There will be. I mean, there's no question. There's the like.
Although you know, there's actually Amazon just announced. This is kind of thinking about the iTunes thing. There needs to be. Everyone says, there needs to be an iTunes for comics. Amazon just announced a program. It's called Amazon Shorts. And for 50 cents, you can buy a short story. You download to your computer. It's a PDF. You can download it whenever you want it. And I've heard rumblings that they're also trying to start a comics version that would be open to both book publishers and independent comic creators.
Right. They'll find
a way to do it. So it's there's people trying to do it. It's just a matter of finding what that like with iTunes. Once iTunes came along, suddenly people are actually paying for their music because they found a way that makes sense, that's easy to use, and that they feel cool using. And it's that same thing. Like once that cinches in,
yeah.
It won't be it'll be fixed. It's just a matter of who's going to be able to do it.
Any last thoughts? Let them free.
Well, thank you guys all so much for hanging out. We're actually going to go out front and we'll have a
sign
and talk and meet and greet, and some of us have books and all that stuff. Thank you guys so much. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Christos Gage, Ross Ritchie, Mark Wade, Tony Fleece, Kazukabu Ishii, and of course the moderator and host of the panel, Josh Fialkoff. From September 29th at the L.A. Central Public Library, five men from the comics industry presenting a panel on the future of graphic literature. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, you can find Word Balloon all over the internet. I hope you like this version of the show. We'll do our best to provide these kinds of panels as we obtain them. I want to thank Josh again for giving us the right to provide this audio. So thanks again, and back to the straight-up interviews coming up next week. So a whole new slate of guys just waiting to talk to me and to you. If you have any questions or comments on the show, please send me an email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007. But really, this is Josh's.